Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat between me, your host, Joseph Paris, and a distinguished business professional. Today's business professional is Andrew Krotowski, Chairman of the Board and Acting CEO for RealWear, and a board member of the Finance Committee for the Rogers Group. Andrew is a senior executive with deep experience in developing teams and strategies that enable innovation, growth, and profitability improvements. As an NACD certified director, qualified technology executive, and a founding executive member of the Digital Directors Network, he strives to improve board performance and digital governance excellence. As an NACD certified director, qualified technology executive, and a founding executive member of the Digital Directors Network, he strives to improve board performance and digital governance excellence to shape and secure the digital future for everyone. Before beginning his civilian career, Andrew served 9 years as a physicist and program manager working on satellite and command control communication intelligence systems. He has held positions of increasing responsibility with Hitachi, Warner Lambert, Pfizer, Energizer, Goodrich Aerospace, UTC, Tyco, and JCI. He holds 2 undergraduate degrees in engineering physics from Oregon State University's Honor Program, where he was a distinguished graduate of Air Force ROTC. He has a master's degree in systems management from the University of Southern California's Institute for Safety and Systems Management, and later completed a certificate of professional development at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Andrew. How are you doing today?
Hi, JP. Doing great. Thanks for having me here.
Awesome. Now, you're on the west coast of the United States, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
That's right. We're just south of Seattle on Puget Sound.
Awesome. That's a beautiful part of the world, isn't it?
It is absolutely gorgeous, and today is especially so with blue skies and a lot of sunshine. So,
awesome.
A perfect spring day.
Awesome. You're able to get out?
Indeed, yeah. In fact, I was just out. The governor just opened up the state to some recreational activities yesterday. So on May 5th, I got my first round of golf in since the COVID-19 shutdowns had begun, and things are beginning to come back to a new normal here in Washington State.
Awesome. Good to hear. Now, you know, I've been following, you know, your goings on here for a while, and, you know, I'm really intrigued about, you know, one of your latest endeavors here. You're being the acting CEO for RealWear. And I think it's a really cool company. And I think the audience would be interested in what RealWear is all about.
Well, great. I'm happy to answer that. RealWear is an exciting company today. It was really founded in the idea of connecting the industrial worker. So if you think about the knowledge business we're in, everyone's gotten very used to having their connected worker experience in the office, but there are literally millions of industrial workers who were not able to be part of that knowledge transfer process. And RealWear was founded as a knowledge transfer company to address that market need. So we've created a wearable, voice-controlled industrial computer that allows all of that functionality with a heads-up, you know, eyes-up, hands-free experience, ruggedized to the point that it can work in industrial environments, including a version that works in inherently safe environments for explosive atmospheres and chemical plants and in the oil and gas industry.
Now, you know, looking at this apparatus, it looks like, you know, for lack of a better term, looks like something a Borg would wear for you Trekkies out there, you know, where there's, you know, something that's in front of the person's or to the side of the person's eye, and they could read a manual. Or I'm trying to give the audience a little bit of a pictorial, you know, mind's eye type of
sure.
view to this.
Absolutely. Well, I think that you're not far off the mark, actually, in that our the origins of the form factor for the HMT1, and that stands for helmet-mounted tablet, because it really does function as a Android tablet computer in just a different form factor. We've replaced the touch and gesture controls with voice controls. But the origin of that form factor goes back to Dr. Stephen Pombo, who was a designer working originally on the Industrial Light and Magic. And so if any of the Star Wars fans out there, and we just got past Star Wars Day here, which I think was May 4th, there was a character called Boba Fett who had a heads-up display that would flip down into his line of sight in his operations. Well, Stephen Pombo designed that and never forgot about the functionality of that heads-up display, and ultimately became part of the form factor considerations for RealWear. So that is, in fact, the origin of the form factor. It is a bilaterally symmetric, so you can use either dominant eye, which is very different from some other designs. It gets to be very fatiguing if you use your non-dominant eye when you're trying to read a heads-up display like that. But it presents as a tablet, about a 7-inch tablet computer being held at a comfortable arm's length from your eyes, and so it's a very readable display in bright sunlight and in the darkness. So it really gives that full functionality while you're completely aware of your surroundings and have complete situational awareness, which is very important for safety and productivity in the workplace.
Yeah, my oldest son works for Lufthansa Technik, and I don't know if you know this, but being up there in the hometown of Boeing, but every airline in the world, every airplane in the world, except for the Russians, all the repair manuals are only in English. Okay, so it doesn't matter if it's Lufthansa, an Airbus, a Boeing, British Airways, Alitalia. It doesn't matter. The repair manuals are only in English because they want to have zero opportunity for an error in translation.
That's exactly right. In fact, I have a pretty strong aviation background myself, both from my Air Force days and working for Goodrich Aerospace and United Technologies Aerospace Systems. So very familiar with that. And in fact, RealWear also has had a number of customers who are in the aviation and aviation services point of view that are exploring the use of that of the HMT-1 for maintenance operations in the hangar and on the flight line.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking about with my son. I mean, he's working on an airplane, and usually you need two hands, and those manuals get kind of beat up, bringing them out there to the field, and of course you have to use the manual. It's not like, oh, I've changed this tire 1,000 times, I could change it again. Everything is like a pre-flight checklist, and you have to do this and you have to do that. And I have to keep on reminding him, like he's got a Land Rover Defender. I keep on reminding him that, listen, if you're done and you still have parts on the ground, you're not done.
That's exactly right. Well, it's actually a number of things that the HMT-1 does for that frontline, first-line worker, right? Because not only can they do a workflow and actually be walked through a procedure and document with both a timestamp and a GPS location for when that work was done. So you get the ability to really model the workflows that are happening, but also give them the access to, an instant training video if they wanted to see again how to change a bearing or see how to change a particular part out. And it gives them the opportunity to connect to a remote expert so that through the HD camera that's mounted on the HMT-1, they can actually see what the worker is seeing real time as they describe the problem, and even with some applications, telestrate the solution, like, oh, it's, tighten this bolt over here, or it's the circuit breaker to your left that's the problem. And so it creates an entire productivity success cycle between being able to access the proper information, document that you've done it properly, and then when uncertain, you're able to get training materials, documents, blueprints, and even a remote expert to walk you through to get the job done right. So it's it truly is a productivity tool that is being discovered even more strongly now with the events of COVID-19 and the global pandemic. Is this idea of having a connected worker in remote work, used to have to be kind of described to people. You'd have to take the customer through sort of that journey of why this is going to be a real big advantage for your first line, frontline workers. And they couldn't really imagine, well, it's not the way we're working today. Where's the ROI? after now dealing with, you know, 8 or so weeks of running their businesses through Zoom meetings like we're meeting here today, or through Microsoft Teams or through Cisco WebEx, you don't have to explain the value of remote collaboration, this idea of telepresence anymore. So now it's all about, yes, we can see that, and boy, oh, you can do that hands-free in a loud environment up to 95 decibels, you know, on the flight line, in the factory, you know, out on the oil derrick. Wow, that's powerful. So that whole sales cycle has been compressed now as people realize the value that's being brought by bringing collaboration, you know, to their frontline and first-line workers.
Yeah, so, I mean, this really plays into your strengths and experience in systems thinking, I would imagine.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's my master's degree was in systems thinking from, or systems management from USC. And it came at a time I was working on quality issues and large program issues for the United States Air Force. And it got me thinking about how to deal with systemic risk, how to create, you know, superior sustainable performance in these complex systems. And ultimately, what it drove me to kind of a philosophy around, you know, solving, first of all, for the people issue, then dealing with the systems themselves, and then finally the discipline to follow that. Because as a young man, you know, going into these programs early on and trying to solve it as a physicist and as a program manager, you think about it's a technical problem. These issues are evolving and are manifesting themselves on these programs or in these systems because of, you know, some technical aspect of the program. And almost inevitably, the problem was actually a people problem, that if you solve that first, you were then able to go into, you know, solving the systems and the discipline problems secondarily. So absolutely, thinking something holistically really did transform the way I thought about any system, whether that was a communications satellite system, a computer system, or, you know, a quality system for a car manufacturer or for an electronics manufacturer like Hitachi, that the concepts apply equally.
I remember when I was very young, you know, probably in high school, maybe even younger, my father was a senior engineer at IBM, OWIGO, Federal Systems Division. And he came home one night and he was, you know, stressed out. And I asked him, I said, you know, what's the problem? And he looked at me and he said, you know, management would be so great if it wasn't for the people problems.
Exactly.
You know, and that struck me. And I'm thinking about, you know, everything that you're doing. And, you know, this is a fairly young company. I mean, you know, you're obviously generating revenue. You have customers. You've been involved with the company for some time. You know, my experience has been when it's a young company, growing company, dynamic company, you know, people, discipline are challenges because you don't have processes in place. I mean, everything's new. So how do you grapple with that?
Well, it's you're really right to the point of how do you begin to scale a business, right? And so in a young startup, one of the things that you find is that oftentimes you have great, innovative, creative people who have signed on early, you know, in a program where there's a lot of risk, you know, for the business even moving forward. And you find out that those folks just don't know what good looks like. They haven't been in a business that has scaled or operated at a level that maybe is necessary. So one of the values I brought when I first joined the company as chairman of the advisory board was helping get that perspective of someone who's been in Fortune 100, Fortune 500 companies and built world-class quality systems, you know, run an operational excellence program and brought those values. You can say, well, this is how good looks like. Now, how do we do that with the constraints that we have, both financial and human resource-wise in a startup, but still follow those principles? And that's something that allowed us, you know, truly to scale the company as we went forward, because we started with the end in mind that we were going to be an industrial company. We were going to be able to service global customers worldwide. And very few companies, when they launch their first product, can say that they were certified in 54 plus countries immediately for sale. Right? So we understood, because we had, you know, good experienced leadership in place, to know what it would take if you're going to sell to a Honeywell, if you're going to sell to you know, a Colgate-Palmolive who operates plants all over the world. You need to have multi-language solutions. You need to be certified to operate in those companies, in those countries. And that was one of the things that that kind of systems approach brought to RealWear early on. It's one of the reasons why we're the leading wearable industrial computer company in the world today.
That's awesome. Now, when you're scaling, I mean, you know, when you're a young company, if sales wants to talk to finance, they just turn around in their chair and say, "Hey, listen, I want to talk to you." As you grow and your resources become, scattered further and further away, how do you maintain that, high speed collaboration, that you had when you're all in the garage?
It's a great point. I think what we're all discovering today is it comes down to sort of three things. It's connectivity, continuity and sort of culture. So first of all, you have to have the physical capability of doing that. Unfortunately, the internet and access today is pretty ubiquitous. And so especially the technology companies haven't experienced much of a bump in this work from home time because they already had most of their folks working on a platform and some kind of collaboration platform. And so you've been able to maintain business continuity. I've been running all of RealWear from, for instance, Microsoft Teams for the last 8 weeks. We do daily stand-ups. We do individual meetings. I've had board meetings and individual calls with employees, et cetera, all with video, all with audio, all from my home office here. So we've really been able to maintain that continuity. And the way you're able to do that in a way that has the same energy is you've got to build a culture that's accepting of that embraces that, we're, distanced here, but we're working together apart. And that really is something that I think is powerful. I saw a recent post on LinkedIn that I actually shared in an all hands with my entire company the other day, where it talked about going back to work. As we contemplate going to the new normal and countries around the world re-engaging their economies. And what the subtext was, going back to work, let's not go back, let's go forward. And so that's what I've embraced with our team is as we go back to work, let's go forward together. And that mentality of, being able to get work done and do it through, what I value is this sort of team-based problem solving that we focus on solutions and sort of the issues themselves, and then you get down to data-driven, right? And that we ask about those things, and if we do those three things, we really do build a culture that can operate whether we're face-to-face and riffing off each other in a very creative design event, or if we're all offline working in a Zoom or Microsoft Teams or a Cisco meeting, and just being able to do the same things electronically. And you just need to sort of make small adaptations for the pauses that are inevitable in sort of these kinds of distance calls. But other than that, you can get it done. And I think that's what everyone's realizing today, and it's going to be part of the new normal, right? When we go back, I think there'll be a whole number of companies who are going to be reevaluating their physical footprints. I talked to the CIO of one of the largest insurance companies in the country. They were operating 19 separate call centers around the world. Those have all been shut down because of COVID, and they're all operating from home. So you think about the service levels that are so easy to measure in a call center now being operated from home, and you begin to ask yourself the question, hey, after this is over, what is the economic return on maybe going back to all 19 of those call centers? Hey, we had 5 different offices in New York, and everyone's been working from home collaboratively for the last 8-10 weeks. Do we need those office spaces? So I think there's going to be a reevaluation of the how people work in a post-COVID world. And I think because of the cultural norms we're going to be establishing that make that effective, it may actually be a better work culture.
One of the things that I see is a real possibility, and something that my company's been embraced actually probably for darn near 15 years. I've always, thought that office space is a gigantic waste. I it's like unoccupied more than half of the time. And telephony, even just 15 years ago, made it such that you didn't have to be in the same building. And what I realized what that did for me was it freed me up to be able to hire the best and have them, if they like South Carolina, I don't need to move to New York. Stay in South Carolina. Now I can hire the best, and the whole thing, like, do you move or do you not move or how do we handle this? I hire the talent, and if they want to stay where they are, that's fine by me. And I think that gives us the potential to really get A players, an A player team, from wherever they might be.
I think that's exactly right. And I think it's this idea of telepresence has been finally enabled by the ubiquitousness of the internet connectivity, right? So it's not just phone, because I don't think phone alone ever establishes
right.
the same kind of relationship as when you can see someone's facial expressions, when you can collaborate on a document real time. These things are very, very important. And so this change is being enabled both by the technologies that have emerged here and the culture to accept it. And one of the reasons that office spaces were so important before in terms of getting this creative thought going is that you looked at communication between people in offices, right? And you found that, and there's been studies in the 80s and 90s that showed this, that if you were working in nearby offices, the amount of collaboration and daily communication was very, very high. If you worked on a different floor, it dropped down dramatically. If you worked, more than two floors away, it's dramatically different. If you worked in another building, it dropped dramatically, and to the point where if you were not on the same campus, it went almost to zero. So there's this big drop-off in communication that happened that drove people to think about, hey, if we want that kind of creative synthesis going on, we need to have people, sort of co-located. And that's true in itself from a, people point of view, but it misses now the ability to just click a button and be face-to-face with someone no matter where they are. And so I think that taking it away from an email culture, a telephone culture, to a telepresence culture is finally erasing that barrier to distance that we've seen demonstrated for decades. And so that will be the X factor, right, as people design the workplaces of the future.
But there's still, challenges to this digital transformation. I mean, it's not that carefree, right?
No, it's certainly not. And one of the things that comes from that as a board member and as a I'm a certified director with the National Association of Corporate Directors, and I do a lot of work with the Digital Directors Network, which looks at sort of digital transformation, cybersecurity risks, etc., and how we do a better job of managing that digital diversity in the boardroom. And I think there are three things that come out of this basic need work from home or extended work culture, and that first of all is the physical connectivity, that we actually have made the investments in the network to be able to enable those things. But secondarily is the security, because now you've got all the problems of bring your own device to work with home and sometimes open Wi-Fi systems, whether it's in a Starbucks or if it's in your home or in your neighborhood, whatever. And then, the ability to actually manage the productivity, because without the productivity, the whole thing is moot, right? We need to be able to make sure that the tools available to folks when they're doing a work-from-home environment are driving the same or better business results than if they were in the office. I just had a conversation with one of our software coders. As I reach out during this COVID crisis, I'm personally reaching out to every employee and checking in on them for their family situation, their health, how they're doing with managing the social distancing. And, this young lady told me that her focus was, I want to get back to the office because I have a dedicated workspace there. She's in a one-bedroom apartment, working from her kitchen table with just herself in a social distancing environment. That environment isn't as productive for her than being able to be in the office. So there's not a one-size-fits-all here. It's going to be a one-size-doesn't-fit-all, and there'll be customized solutions. I think the leading companies are going to develop cultures that bring people together, because you can't replace the human-to-human connection in those face-to-face meetings, the dinners together, the having a lunch together, that physical proximity. But it's going to also be complemented by being able to then operate wherever you are around the world in a global footprint as this telepresence enables. And I think that's what you're going to see is this coming together and working apart as a normal part of daily business.
Yeah, that's I think that some people too need the structure of an office in order to thrive. You know, it takes a certain individual to be able to work autonomously or semi-autonomously, you know, remotely. Certainly, the surroundings they have to work at their home. I have an office here, and it's quiet and it's private and it's segregated from the rest of the living space. But if you don't have that, or you need that structure, it's got to be like you said, it's not one size fits all. So I think we're gonna have to make sure that we understand the people that we hire and what circumstances they require in order to thrive. And I think that's going to require a little bit more customization. What do you think?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, that we're going to be looking at where do people work best from, and how do you accomplish the workflow, which is really what we're talking about. Work product that always is an outcome of a process, whether it's a manufacturing process or a business process, right? And some of those things can be done remotely and separately. Others need to be done, in collaboration, in synchronicity. And then things like manufacturing, our service industries, our service technicians. I mean, there's no option for them to work from home. And so that's where this idea of a connected industrial worker comes into play, because for those folks, they've got to be on the front line, and we've got to provide tools for them to have the same kind of functionality that they would have and that are enjoyed and now appreciated by the folks who can do be characterized as a knowledge worker, whether they be in the office or in another location for themselves. So this is like a network of how do we get the business of business done in a way that is the most productive, least cost. It's the same challenge we've met from the beginning, but we've just got new tools and new techniques available to us to do it better.
Yeah, I agree. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the innovation and the future of work. So you've been listening to State of Readiness. I'm Joseph Paris, your host.
This episode of State of Readiness, sponsored by Zonatech Consulting Group International, an operations management consultancy firm serving companies and organizations from around the world. Our offerings include strategic advisory on business operations, technology, business transformation, international expansions, and building a culture of leadership. We also specialize in helping companies architect and deploy their continuous improvement and operational excellence programs. Learn more at www.zonitech.com, ZONITEK.com.
Welcome back. This is Joseph Paris, and you're listening to State of Readiness. With us today, I have Andrew Krastowski. And Andrew, we left off promising people we're going to talk about innovation and the future of work. I mean, you seem, and RealWear seems to be directly addressing the future of work.
We are. I think we've been on the leading edge of the future of work, and certainly industrial work from the beginning. This idea that you need to have the same advantages for connected industrial workers. So when we look at the challenges of work, and I think, when we talk about the future of work now, everyone's kind of putting a pause there, the future of work after COVID-19. And we see that there's I see three major things are going to flow with that. And by the way, as at least in the United States, as they start talking about bringing supply chain back home, if there'll be less dependency on sort of these international weakened supply chains, et cetera. So there'll be, idea of, hey, we got to bring more work back to the States. Well, if you do that, you don't have the workforce today to be able to support that activity. So the future of work, as you begin to think about it, tells me there's going to be, more dependence on automation, because as the demographics don't support the industrial base that you need to have, you're going to have, by definition, more automation. It means the future of work is going to be more interconnected. The idea that we're going to be in the Internet of Things world, everything connected, everything, collecting data, that all happening real time, whether it's real time collaboration or remote expert working with a frontline worker right away, or an immediate maintenance thing being flagged by a piece of equipment. This idea of being interconnected real time and then being assisted, this data-rich, information-rich world is going to be massaged in the background by AI, artificial intelligence, machine learning, to provide insights to people. You know, back when we were first learning about computers, when I was, you know, early in the 70s, it was like, well, don't mistake, you know, data for information. Data is just a series of you know, pieces of information, but information is actionable, right? So this idea that all of this data that's going to be generated in a world that's interconnected in real time is going to require you know, some very active AI and machine learning engines behind it, which can then, you know, move those insights to back into workflows for company, whether that workflow is going to be handled by a credit risk by someone on a credit desk, or maybe it'll be to a frontline worker who now a machine nearby has sensed that person's presence and said, hey, I've got a technician that's only 100 yards away and I'm needing my bearings lubricated, so I'm going to give a heads up to the employee here, and he'll get a indicator on his HMT1 that, hey, I've got a machine that needs maintenance, and guide them over to it and then walk them through the procedure and then do the work. So, you know, that's where I see the future of work is this very much, you know, interconnected, real time, and enabled by this background of AI and machine learning that's going to be operating within it. There's just no way at a human scale to process the kind of information that's going to be there that's going to change the level of productivity that we've been kind of bumping up against for the last 10 years. If you look at the productivity growth rates in industrialized companies, they kind of topped out a bit. They've been plateaued. And I think that what we're describing as the future of work here is going to be the thing that's going to break through that plateau.
You know, in one of the notes that you sent me here in preparation for this conversation, you wrote, if data is the new oil, mm-hmm. data analytics are the pumps.
That's exactly.
I get the visual, okay, because I've done a lot of oil and gas work, okay, so I get the visual here. But, you know, maybe if you could snap that a little bit more into focus, because it really is a provocative statement.
Yeah, I'm happy to. And again, RealWear does a lot of work in the oil and gas industry because we've got the only certified, you know, ATEX Zone 1, Div 1, Class 1 kind of device that can go into an explosive atmosphere. So this is an important part of our character. And oil and gas have really driven the Industrial Revolution, right? We talk about the various industrial revolutions and are we in, you know, Industry 4.0 now, et cetera. The oil and gas, that's been the energy that has driven all of these improvements. So we talk about oil as being that reservoir that's created power, but if you don't get the oil out of the ground and move it, you know, from, you know, upstream to midstream and then finally to downstream to where you can put it into your car, or you can put it, you know, into your oil tank to run your home heating, or if you don't put it into the natural gas to run your electric plant, nothing happens. And so the same way, data sitting somewhere in a huge data lake is just the same idea of oil sitting in the ground. It has potential value, but no value until you extract it. And the only way to extract information at the scale that we're talking about in terabytes and petabytes of data is going to be with robust AI, artificial intelligence algorithms and machine learning algorithms that can then make sense and meaning out of that at a human scale and drive action ultimately to the person, you know, operating the process or the person holding the wrench to get the work done.
That's amazing. Yeah, I agree. And I just love that visual. And you wrote another thing that was right after it, and a little, I wrote it on a sticky note here. Because you're in the innovation business, okay? You're taking some real, cutting-edge applications of technology and really putting the power at the point of presence, right at the point where it's needed. But you wrote here, opportunity resides at the edges of the system where value is created. And I thought that's another just like, you know, one of those taglines that's just hanging out there. It should be in a little bubble in my office here as I'm saying it. So, you know, what do you mean by that? I mean, I have my vision, but what do you mean by opportunity resides at the edges of the system where value is created?
I think the way I've always looked at this, and actually goes back to a construct I had early in my life of thinking about your experiences, you know, everything that you have about what you understand, what you can do, what you've mastered resides in sort of this three-dimensional bubble that surrounds you. So everything inside that is, you know, terra cognita, and things that, you know, land that you know, and everything outside that bubble is terra incognita, where you don't know what you haven't mastered. And so growth, the idea of personal growth, the idea of industrial growth, the idea of cultural growth is always going to happen at that interface, that boundary between what you know and what's been understood and what's yet not understood. And I think that that interface is what's fascinating to study, because that's where, you know, growth happens. That's where risk is taken, and where, you know, risks are taken, opportunity is revealed, right? So we're seeing that, you know, in every crisis there are opportunities that are being revealed to how to survive this. We look at, you know, constraints that have been put in place on, you know, whatever that might be. When you remove that constraint, you say, what if I didn't have that constraint? What could I do? And then you find a way around it. So I've always thought about this bubble that surrounds a human being, the bubble that surrounds a business or an industry. And sometimes, you know, that is, we talk about the innovator's dilemma, where, you know, you get the value of Kodak inventing the digital camera and then never being able to get out of its way, because that bubble for Kodak was simply film, right? The profitability, the processing of film, the whole infrastructure was all film in that circle. And so there was no place on this boundary for digital photography, and ultimately the bubble collapsed on Kodak. And I think that that's where, you know, this idea to recognize where those boundaries are within an industry, and then ask what would it take to expand or go through that barrier, is when companies can thrive. And so if you think about, you know, the where RealWear came into this opportunity, it was again this idea of, hey, everyone's a knowledge worker, everyone works, you know, and has the value of this internet collaboration and instantaneous telepresence, and yet industrial workers are putting on their hard hat and walking out onto to the job site or into the factory, and they're disadvantaged relative to that. So if you provide the technology link that allows them to then hands-free, you know, eyes up to have situational awareness, operate safely in that as a connected worker, you've now unleashed value. And one of the things I always say, and I learned this as an operational excellence person, right, as I work through transformations within manufacturing and production systems, is that when you remove friction from a system, you create value. So whatever is slowing you down, whatever's adding cost, whatever is delaying things, if you remove that friction, you create value. So I think all those frictions tend to reside at the edges of where systems are currently operating. And it's those insightful companies who can get past the innovator's dilemma and look beyond what they know inside to the opportunity on the outside that are going to be the ones who are going to continue to grow and change industries.
You know, I see these challenges, COVID in this particular case. A few years back, it was the dot bombs, and you had the Great Recession. I see these calamities always producing a leap forward in advancements. You know, so for instance, I'm on the board of advisory board of Binghamton University in their System Science and Industrial Engineering department. And for years, I've been hearing about how distance learning universities can't, you know, shine a light on, you know, these, you know, bricks and mortar universities, you know, that they're deliverables, substandard, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And how quickly they abandoned the bricks and mortar when COVID hit, and fully embraced telephonic learning. It was as if a light switch went on, and now they're talking about making it permanent or semi-permanent and expanding its use. And you know, just think about it. You know, just a couple of years ago, people were looking down on this form of education, and now it's like, well, all the rage. Heck, in fact, Governor Cuomo in New York is talking about transforming the way primary education is delivered because of this. And you know, a year ago, if that was mentioned, there'd be laughter. And now people are talking about it seriously.
Absolutely. And you know, it's the same issue. Again, it's the same set of natural laws that fit all of these different scenarios. But you think about it, you know, one-on-one, you know, what's always been talked about, the student-teacher ratios, right? And individualized learning, and how do we grow the best out? Well, you know, clearly, if you think about the future of education and what Billy needs versus what Sally needs, what Jose needs versus what, you know, Maria might need, you know, if you have a customized delivered learning system that is focused on, you know, in a computer-driven learning mode, you know, those avatars can track what each of the individual learning processes, provide information and context that the student succeeds with, and teachers now can actually be able to provide the human input, the reinforcement, the encouragement, right? Because they're not doing the other stuff, and so you right. do you let machines and machine learning and AI drive things that does best, and you use now the human element to drive what humans do best. And I think that's one of the things that the future of work is holding for us, is that when you can automate a process that previously required a human being to do it, whether it's, you know, preparing a P&L or closing the books on a business, right? We used to have teams of people working for a week or more to prepare that. Maybe now that can all be automated. You say, well, what do those people do now? Well, those people can now be engaged in the more human parts of the business, right? Where it requires more judgment or more direct intervention. So I think we're going to see a world that is, you know, simultaneously a higher automation where those things come into play and telepresence takes a larger role, and the value that people bring to the interhuman, the interpersonal reactions are going to be valued even greater. So I think that is part of the culture that's going to be an outcome. And so certainly education has long been due for a reboot to make sure that all students get the education they deserve, and that we deal with the limited population of people who are qualified teachers, just as we have to deal with the limited number of qualified tool makers that we have in the United States, right? Try to find a good tool maker in the U.S. today. It's very difficult, right? You think about these jobs that are hard to re-bring back on because they've been, you know, sourced to other countries or whatever. Now we can start talking about jobs there where people can be educated in a different way, do their work in a different way, and the part about being, you know, a human becomes even more important as machines can do more.
Yeah. So you are ready for the speed round?
Sure, let's do it.
All right. So, who is the one leader you look up to most and why?
I think in my life, it has to be Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, to answer that, you know, in a short story, I was born in Washington, D.C. in the United States, and my father took me as a young boy to the cherry blossom season there. So if you can imagine all the beautiful cherry trees that were a gift from Japan in bloom, and then going to the Washington Memorial, Washington Monument, and then the Lincoln Memorial. And I remember all the things that this leader did for the company, or for the country that was in crisis, that was at a huge inflection point culturally, and, you know, suffered, you know, tremendous personal loss, and ultimately lost his life in the pursuit of that dream. Left an indelible mark about the leadership and duty to a higher cause. So I have to say that's Lincoln.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites. I lived a year in Manassas, Virginia, and when I was 16 to 17 years old, and my father and I would go to the mall, the National Mall there, and my favorite ended up being TJ, Thomas Jefferson. He ended up being my favorite. But you also went to Gettysburg, too. I mean, I did some campouts with the Scouts, because I was from upstate New York. I did some campouts with the Scouts at Gettysburg, and you know, that you look at the acres and the acres of the monuments and where people fought and died, and it's just it's a transformational moment if you, you know, think of the time and the place and what was happening there, and the, you know, the pulling on the, and the pushing on the nation.
It was absolutely
dramatic. So anyway, what's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
The best piece of professional advice ever received was work your boss's priorities, right? When you think about what needs to be done, and it helps you operate at whatever level you are. It helps bring you to the next level of management or executive performance. If you think about what your boss's priorities are, and then make sure that the work you're doing supports that, it will drive you forward in your career. And I've actually, I refer to what many call Hoshin planning, others have referred to as policy deployment. I always refer to it as priority deployment, because it's a way that you connect everyone in the organization and their activities directly linked back to the key operational priorities of the business. And to me, that's a huge lever for any business anywhere. So that would be my issue, or my best advice I ever got was work your boss's priorities.
You know, interestingly, I've been contacted by many former directors of OpEx CI programs over the last few weeks with this COVID crisis, and they've been recently made former OpEx or CI directors. And almost to a T, it's because they weren't working on what was important.
That's right.
They had their idea of what was important, but they never cross-checked it against their true customer, which is, as you said, their boss. All right. And what that ends up happening is that they're a nice to have, not a need to have. And knowing what's important is probably most important.
Right. Well, knowing where the value levers are for the business, you have to understand that, and you have to support it. And if you do, and you make that, and you advance the ball in those areas, you're going to be considered essential.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, strategic instead of logistical.
Exactly.
What's a personal habit that contributes to your success?
For me, it's getting up early to have that personal time for a little meditation and some workout to kind of focus my day. That's certainly a daily ritual, and one that I started in my 20s was journaling, where I would maintain journals of my individual thoughts, annual goals, what I'm doing, to be able to look back over time. It's funny how when you don't have data, you can kind of convince yourself that things were different than you remember. It's a whole other thing to pull out your journal entry from 10 years ago, read what was going on, and you put yourself exactly back in that mindset, and you go, no, I really did say I was going to do that, and I didn't do it, or I set that as a goal, and I got it done. So I'd say those three things together have been certainly transformative for myself.
Super, super. So the last question is kind of a sometimes it trips up people, but we'll see how you do, because it's three parts. If you had one do-over in your life, personal, professional, doesn't matter, one do-over in your life, what would it be, why, and what would you do different?
Yeah, that's a great question, which we say in the biz is a bridge to buy me some time to think. As a do-over, right, the one thing that I learned later in life that I wish I could, write a letter back to myself, whether it was at 17 or at 20 in college, whatever, is that it's all about people. I was trained as a physicist. I came out with degrees in engineering and physics and then systems management. And it took me a long time to realize that, while solving problems is all, the data piece of that, the mechanics, the leadership aspect of getting things done, it wasn't until you understand that really it's people and relationships, and it's your network of humans that you can connect and solve problems with, that really is a value driver in your life. So, you get sort of the it's not what you know, it's who you know advice early on, and that rings a little bit hollow and self-centered.
Yeah.
But when you think about it in the context of your real role is to be able to solve problems and get things done, and all of the important things I've ever gotten done, I've gotten done through, teams of people who have been aligned around work. And so the toughest challenges, the biggest challenges, require leaders to connect with their folks, to be able to bring out the best in their people. And, it took me too long in my career to actually kind of materialize all of those thoughts and synthesize them to a management philosophy. So my do-over would be to be aware of that, early on. And I tell every every student. In fact, I just had a colleague whose son is going to just got accepted to New York University's China program. So he'll be going to his undergraduate program in Shanghai next year. And, you know, I told him that the one piece of advice is your network. You're going to come out of that program not only completely bilingual and bicultural, but you're also going to have an unprecedented network both within China, but also all the other countries that will be coming there for that program and the United States. So, you know, this is the idea of making value of all of your human connections is just so important to success and to living a fully rich and a productive life.
Yeah, you know, I'm just going to add a couple of things there because I agree with you 100%. The first is that just because you're there doesn't mean you've created the network. You actually have to do the work.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Just being in the proximity of other people and great minds means nothing unless you know, extend your hand out and say, "Hi, I'm Joe Paris." You know what I mean?
And it's that and emotional connection. It's right. It's connecting with those people in a way that then you know those people. You know, one of the things my personal advice to everyone today is to, you know, operate on a platform like LinkedIn, where you can not only curate these relationships over time, right? So, you know, when your network gets to be the size of, you know, thousands and thousands like you and I have, it becomes a little bit, without a system, it becomes hard to connect with them. But it also becomes almost an automatic memory refresh system because you get those periodic, it's somebody's birthday or it's somebody's anniversary or it's somebody's work anniversary or someone just changed jobs. And so you're refreshing those networks on a regular basis. So, you know, these are tools today that make what we did with Rolodexes and a phone, you know, through the 70s, 80s, and 90s now able to be done, you know, even more productively. So yeah, it's all about people, relationships, and getting things done. And by the way, that's giving is an important part of that is actually getting, right? That network doesn't work unless you're putting more into it to help other people than you are looking to get stuff out for yourself.
Yeah, that's a great point because it can't be transactional. You know what I mean? It can't be like, I'm going to give you something and I'm expecting something immediately in return. You know what I mean? You have to just, you know, you have to just be a giving person, a sharing person, and you have to just believe that good things will happen in its own time. But if you're trying to predict and map out exactly what's going to happen by whom, when, first off, you're doing it completely wrong. And secondly, nothing good will ever come from it. You know, the relationships
really
have to be genuine.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. It's really just the way the universe works, right? If you don't put it out into the universe of how you treat people and how you help and what you give, you'll never be able to access, you know, all of the creative leverage that comes from those kinds of relationships and actions. And you never know when you'll have that George Bailey moment, you know, from It's a Wonderful Life, where everybody who you've been there for suddenly is there for you. It's
right.
Just not possible if you haven't put in the work. And you know, the great little secret about that is you have a more enriching and fulfilling life if you live that way anyway. So even if you never have to take out of that emotional bank, putting into it is itself an enriching experience and makes this journey together so much more pleasurable.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. Well, Andrew, I'd like to thank you for joining me today on State of Readiness. It's been a real pleasure having this this deep conversation with you and learning about RealWare and your journey. So I want to thank you for taking that time to share it with me and my audience.
Well, thank you very much, JP. And perhaps someday we can get back again and do some deep dives into some of the great thoughts you have in State of Readiness about, you know, particulars on how do you build operational excellence, or what are the levers for quality, or what are the kinds of questions that many of your audience members might have on the nuts and bolts of actually creating value in a complex organization.
Well, maybe I'll let you turn the tables on me sometime. That would be kind of interesting. It's never actually crossed my mind. So, yeah, who knows? So, you've been listening to another episode of State of Readiness. I've been your host, Joseph Paris, and our guest has been Andrew Krostowski, Chairman of the Board and Acting CEO of RealWare. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.